Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is conductor and film composer John Jasinski. But let's start with this. There's a new study by Medea Research that found out that the largest consumer group for music is between 25 and 34. They're also most likely to become music aficionados. But here's the thing. They grew up during the transition between physical music and streaming. And as a result, they now listen to more radio and CD and vinyl than they do streaming. The fact of the matter is, they don't really like algorithms picking music for them, and they feel it's way too passive. It's important for this age group to have music chosen by a human. Now, that's opposed to a younger age group of 16 to 19 who are growing up on AI and are growing up on AI algorithms that are feeding them music recommendations. Now, just go up a little bit to ages 20 to 24, and that feels completely alien to them. So as a result, streaming platforms are getting more homogenous, trying to cope with the different tastes across age groups, or they're going the opposite way, trying to be hyper-tailored to one particular age group. So this is a real problem because the streaming platforms, and this includes Spotify and Amazon Music and Apple Music, they're not sure who exactly to cater to. And as we all know, if you try to cater to everyone, then no one is happy. And that's what we're going towards right now, where we're finding that people are not as happy with their streaming services as they were before. If money gets tight and they have to eliminate a service, they're more likely to eliminate a music service than they are a video streaming service. So when we look at all these streaming services, we see that all of a sudden the growth that was so prevalent for the last 5 years, that's kind of leveled off, and it may not get any better in the future. So if you thought that streaming platforms weren't catering to what you like, don't feel bad, because unless you're a teenager, it's happening to everyone. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can find out all about my books, including The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, AI for Music Production, and the Music Mixing Workbook, and more at bobbyosinski.com. There you can also read excerpts from all my books and learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter. That's bobbyosinski.com. Now, one of the things when it comes to acoustic isolation is that it's not cheap. And the reason for that is it requires very, very brute wall construction with real thick walls and air spaces in between. But there's still some progress that is being made on new sound suppression materials. One is a collaboration between many universities to come up with a thin silk piezoelectric fabric, and it's barely thicker than a human hair. And supposedly, when it's fully developed, it could create quiet spaces. Now, these fibers act like noise-canceling headphones, but instead of actually canceling out the sound, the fibers don't vibrate at all, so they act like a mirror. The difference between other experimental technologies and this is most other technologies are really good at a very specific frequency band. It's usually a mid-frequency band. But this one is different because the fabric has different pore sizes for different frequencies. So as of now, they can reduce the transmission up to 75%, and hopefully that's going to get a lot higher. Unlike other university experiments in sound isolation, this one actually might gain traction because it's funded by the National Science Foundation, the Army Research Office, and the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. So deep pockets get faster results. My guest this week is conductor John Jasinski, who is currently conducting premier orchestras around the world and fully restored film score performances. Among the shows that he's conducted include Harry Potter in Concert, Star Trek The Ultimate Voyage, Amadeus, as well as The Godfather Live. John is also a freelance film composer, scoring short and feature-length films, as well as trailer and source music for top production companies. Several of his short scores have made appearances and won awards at film festivals around the world. during graduate studies at NYU Film School, where he studied privately with renowned film orchestrator Sonny Kampanek, as well as film composer Ira Newborn, John was awarded the prestigious Elmer Bernstein Award for Film Composition. During an interview, John spoke about the hardest thing a conductor has to learn, the preservation of legendary scores, the differences between the many orchestras he's conducted, tight film scoring budgets, augmenting scores with samples, and so much more. I spoke with John via Zoom from his office in Los Angeles. You're doing a lot of things that I don't see other people doing, so we'll get into those as we go, but let's talk about your background. You started in music kind of late, right?
I did. I did. My family's always been more of a sports family, and going all the way back generations. I've actually looked in my family tree. No one so much as played a guitar, picked up a kalimba, anything like that, going very far back. And so I kind of had to discover it on my own. And around the age of 12 or 13, I was snooping around my mom's office, just looking to see what cool things the adults had in there. And I found her cassette tape collection of Elton John and Billy Joel's greatest hits. And I just put it in my little kid's cassette player and instantaneously fell in love with Billy Joel and Elton John. And from there, I was off. But yeah, it was a late start. And even with that, my parents having no knowledge about the music industry or music production, making, anything like that, endlessly supportive. But it took a little convincing that I was serious about it, because they thought, oh, he's a kid, he'll get over it. He's excited about a new shiny toy. And it wasn't until we were in a mall, when those existed, they had a display piano in the courtyard. And I just sat down and started playing Benny and the Jets on it. And it was at that moment that my parents realized I wasn't just being kind of a fickle kid about it. And like, oh, okay, we should probably get in lessons. They're actually a little terrified that this was happening and they didn't know about it at all. So yeah, we're off from there.
Where did you learn to play?
Just by ear. I had a little plastic keyboard, only about that big. And so I would just poke things out. I would pour over the recordings. Mostly, again, it was a very limited scope. I had one track mind, which is Billy Joel and Elton John. And I burnt holes in those cassette tapes practically. I melted the tape. I'm all by ear at first. And then finally, after they realized I was serious about it, they found a lovely little old lady in the neighboring town, and I was off to piano lessons, not knowing what to expect. So,
and was that classically based then that you were learning?
I was very lucky to have the piano teacher that I did, because she instilled the basics in me. And again, I was, even though I was 12 or 13, I was practically a five-year-old in terms of my musical knowledge. And so she made sure I had those foundations set and was very kind and forgiving. But at the end of each one of our hour-long lessons, she would dedicate 10 minutes to just playing what I wanted to play. So it was kind of that way of, play this Diabert, which is a lesson book that I learned off of from Alfred Music Publishing, which I later worked for. So we would do most of it from there. And then at the end, I would get to play Piano Man for a few minutes, and she would, you know, teach me how to do the fingerings for Piano Man if I was a little confused by it. So that kept me going. And I would practice for 7 hours a day just because I wanted to. It wasn't a chore to me. It was just making music. It was like I unlocked this whole new arena of being able to express myself and just to sound like these two guys that were really cool, and I wanted to be really cool too. So yeah.
So since you come from a sports family, did you play sports, or did this get in the way?
No, I did. My parents, we didn't have a ton of money growing up, but my parents had the mindset of, if something is making our kids' lives better, if something's enriching their lives, we do it. And so they would sacrifice everything for themselves, or everything from themselves, to give us anything. And we didn't know any of this growing up. We never felt like we were wanting for anything because we weren't. So yeah, I would go play piano, and then I'd go to baseball, and I was a pitcher, and I kept that up through college, actually. And yeah, I mean, there were a few times where I would get beamed by an inside fastball, and I'd jam my thumb and not be able to play piano at the next lesson, which, I taught you how to alternate your fingers and figure out a new way to approach the problem. So it's a good thing in a few different senses.
When you decided to go to college, you obviously took music and you went to a really great school. Was there any pushback from your parents about that?
No. From the get-go, as soon as they realized in that mall that I was serious about it, again, they didn't understand it necessarily, but they weren't afraid of it. They knew that it was a tough life, and they made sure that I understood that. I also had amazing, truly phenomenal teachers growing up, music teachers specifically. So they gave me so much spectacular guidance. I knew what I was getting into, and they sort of knew what I was getting into too. And they made it very clear that try this, give it your all, and don't be ashamed if nothing comes of it, because that happens for a lot of people, and that doesn't mean you have to give up music. You can still do it for fun, but 100% go do it. So I had their full support on that, even though to this day they still don't really know what it is exactly that I do. They support me nonetheless. They come to all my concerts, but when it comes to like, so what's your work schedule? I don't know. I'll find out a week before the gig, and but they just can't compute. They hate that. They like having that 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, and God bless them for it.
So when did you get the bug for film composition?
That was one. It's kind of a progression, because I started with Billy Joel just wanting to be a rock star. And I didn't like Beethoven. I didn't like Bach. I didn't like Chopin, these things that I had to learn to get better at piano. But I really was doing it all in the hopes of playing rock music. Slowly, though, they started to creep into, what I would actually listen to for fun. And it grew from there and blossomed from there, and I developed this really strong passion for classical music, and that kind of set me up to be receptive to film music. And like a lot of people, my introduction to film music was the music of John Williams, because when your dad watches Indiana Jones with you, for the first time, and you hear that theme come rip roaring out of the speakers, you can't help but whistle along, and it gets stuck in your head, just like Williams is a master of doing. And that started piquing my interest pretty early. So John Williams, James Horner, Danny Elfman, those were kind of the three that really sunk their claws into me. And I bought every tape that I could of all of their soundtracks, but I never really connected, hey, I want to do this, until I was, I believe, a freshman in high school. And I saw Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone when it came out in theaters. And from the very first moment, I don't know if your listeners or you recall the beginning of the film, but it just starts in darkness. And then when that Warner Brothers shield comes on the screen, like all of their movies, you just had this flurry of notes and an instantaneous sounding of the main theme of Harry Potter. And I got this massive chill down my spine. And I was just sitting in that theater, and the whole first scene, I was thinking, could I do this? Could I instantaneously transport people like just happened to me? And I realized that I had to. There was no going back and forth on it. At that point, my path was set. So I was going to be a composer, and specifically for film.
The interesting thing here is you can learn a lot about playing piano, but it's a leap to get into orchestration, composition and orchestration, right?
I had the audacity to just go for it, which is a good thing in some ways, and I failed spectacularly. It's as we often do when we try something new for the very first time. I actually keep the very first things that I wrote And I didn't compose something for the piano first. I didn't compose something for guitar or just one instrument. I wrote for the full orchestra because that's what James Horner did. And it sounded exactly like James Horner. And it was terribly orchestrated because I didn't know what the orchestra could play at the time. But by God, I went for it. And I look at it now and I chuckle to myself. But at the same time, I admire the audacity and the desire from this young kid to want to play in that sandbox. And they really were my first teachers with orchestration were John Williams and James Horner. I wish in person, but through their soundtracks and from their sheet music, I would just study those things night and day, night and day, and occasionally see friends and family too. But anytime I wasn't with them, it was that, and that's really how I taught myself to compose for the first time.
Now, the other skill is conducting.
Yes.
And again, there's a leap to get into that. The average musician would look at a conductor and say, oh, I can do that. That's easy. But there's more to it than that, right?
Oh yeah, and I did the same thing too. I played in bands and orchestras before I was ever waving a stick around, and I had that same thought of, what is this guy doing? I could do this better. And I'd have teachers where I'd be sitting in a choir saying, "That's I wouldn't do it like that." It's a completely different story when you're up there in front of your peers. And like a lot of the things in my life and my professional life especially, the biggest changes and the most rewarding changes come out of left field. Sorry for the baseball pun, but I guess it's apropos. Conducting was something that I took because if I were going to be a film composer, I would have to record my music. And I didn't want to stand up in front of 80 or 100 musicians in a recording studio when time is money and look like a dummy. And so I thought, well, I have to get a basic set of skills in this so that I can do it. And it was such an eye-opening experience to go in for my very first lesson. Because again, you're not one-on-one like with piano lessons, where if you fail or if you make a mistake, it's one kindly old lady who just giggles and tells you to try it again. It's all of your peers. And I learned very quickly that the number one key to be a conductor, and I still tell this to kids today when I'm giving master classes, is you can't be afraid to look goofy and you can't be afraid to look silly. Because all the things we do as conductors, if you were just alone in a room or standing in the middle of some public courtyard making the faces or the gestures that we make without any orchestra, people would think you were nuts. And that's kind of part of the beauty of it. So letting that go is one of the most difficult parts of being a conductor. But yeah, it was a giant leap that came out of a practical necessity that I like other things, I fell in love with over time.
Is there one thing about conducting that you wish the average person knew?
Sure, yeah. A lot of people who haven't conducted or they aren't in orchestras, they'll come up to me and, yeah, you wave your arms around and they make music from it. And yeah, to some degree, that's correct if you boil it down to it. People ask me why conductors are important, usually. And sometimes conductors think they're a little too important. It's myself included occasionally. However, I always tell them, how many recordings are there of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony? And they usually say a lot. And I say, well, the reason for that is because of conductors. They have different interpretations. Otherwise, what's the point of recording it if you get it right once? That's our recording of Beethoven's Ninth that we can use for all of history. And obviously technology gets better as well too. But yeah, conductors can impart so much personality. And it's really a song and dance and a duet with the orchestra because they inject their personality and we inject ours. And together, that's where this unique, beautiful performance can come from. And so really, as a conductor, I want people to know that I'm not the boss in the orchestra. I'm just another musician. I'm a member of the orchestra. It's just me singing a tune and the orchestra singing a tune right back, and we're coming up with our own unique interpretation of it. So that was a long way of saying that we inject a lot of personality into
One of the things that I learned as a young musician was how important dynamics are. And if you don't have dynamics in your music, then there's no feeling. And to me, a conductor, that's what a conductor is bringing, among other things. But the major thing is, okay, how does the orchestra breathe?
Yeah, you can't have big, glorious moments without the quiet moments that precede it, the spaces. I always, when I'm working with an orchestra, I sound like a broken record about it, but the spaces in between the notes are sometimes more important than the notes themselves, especially something that's percussive, Stravinsky, or John Williams, even when I'm conducting a lot of his music. It's the quiet moments, it's the spaces where you let the sound linger and die off on its own accord, according to the room. That's way more important than the two jaws notes. It's right after you're building up and then you stop and then you come right back in with this big forceful sound, but it's that gap, that breath, with the whole orchestra. And when everybody does it at the same time and you just have that dip of sound before this glorious reentrance, oh, it can be absolutely spellbinding. And I still get that chill like I did in the movie theater with Harry Potter when it goes well.
Okay, well, let's go there for a second, because now you're working with Cine Concerts and what's the other one?
AVEX. I'm an independent contractor, so I work with pretty much anyone who'll throw a job at me, as any good musician does. But yeah, my frequent collaborators are AVEX, Cine Concerts, certainly, as well as a few others that film live in concert. There are new ones coming out every day. And I always am fascinated by the new films that come out. And they're such rewarding relationships to have. When I actually started in this, it was another surprise career moment coming out of left field. I didn't start as a conductor. In fact, the head producer of Cine Concerts and owner had no idea I could conduct. I came on as a restoration musician. So we were doing The Godfather, and they were just about to do The Godfather live. And we had Nina Rota's handwritten manuscript. So like actually in my possession, wearing gloves, these beautifully written, the penmanship was astounding. It's a lost art these days, this actual good notation penmanship. But I was holding these real things in my hands. And so it was kind of dual purpose. So we were creating this show and I was entering into finale and we were finding in the soundtrack where, okay, they wrote this note, but what they actually performed was this, probably because Coppola said, try this instead. And they changed it from the stand. So we had to find all those things.
Wow.
So that's part of creating a show, but it's also the preservation, because paper doesn't last forever, as everyone knows. And, you know, I've heard horror stories about, film scores being lost because they're in the music library and in the studio and there's a flood in the building or a fire. And I think they may have lost the original King Kong and other scores, and they're just lost to time. We only have the recorded music because nobody made copies or kept them elsewhere. So it's not only getting this show set up, it's having a digital record, certainly not as beautiful as Nina Rota's handwriting, but it's there in case the unthinkable happens. So I'm working on this for a few months, and it's a great experience because I get to be a professional nerd and do exactly what I used to do as a teenager, which is pore over scores. And they have the nonsensical idea to pay me for it when I would gladly pay them for it. And in conversation, I just mentioned that I had taken some conducting classes. And so one day, Justin Freer, the owner of Cine Concerts, he casually brought up, hey, you mentioned you took some conducting classes before, right? So yeah, he's like, great. I need you in Montreal in 3 days. Learn The Godfather. It shouldn't be too hard for you. You did it. And of course, I'm like, sure thing. And got it. Hung up the phone and had a minor meltdown. Like, how am I gonna do this? Sure enough, 3 days later, I had learned some basic French. I was on a plane to Montreal, and I had learned The Godfather, syncing it up to film and everything like that. And I was off from there. Another surprise turn in my career that ended up being the last 10 years of my career primarily. It really steered me away from film composing, actually. I'm just now starting to split my time more evenly, but it was quite a whirlwind that was so unexpected, this global tour of conducting these film concerts that has been so incredibly rewarding, and I just had no idea it was coming whatsoever.
Okay, well, that's a good subject to talk about. So you're conducting all over the world, and obviously it's a different orchestra every time.
Yes.
How different were the orchestras from one place to another?
Yeah, it's that's always I work with a lot of the same orchestras because at this point, especially with the Harry Potter series, there's eight of those films, so you get to know the orchestra well. But every time I work with a new orchestra, there's always that moment where we're sort of getting a feel for one another. They don't know me. I have a baby face, and they think I'm just some kid stepping up there onto the podium. Do I know what I'm talking about? Am I going to make their lives difficult because I can't conduct? I don't know the music. And I'm looking at them going, gosh, this music's really hard. How are the violins going to do with it? Am I going to have to adjust my conducting because they played really behind? So we're all having these things. And then I purposely always pick, when I work with a new orchestra, a piece of music that everybody would be able to hum, everybody would be able to recognize. And we play that first, even if it's difficult. Everybody at least knows how it sounds. And sometimes it crashes and burns. But I don't even look at the movie. I don't sync it up with the movie. We just practice it like we would a concert performance where it's just the two of us. And we have this, Leonard Bernstein used to call it this touch moment where we just reach our hands out and we just go, oh, hi there. And we realize so much about each other. And after that, it's great. It's just making music with friends at that point. And you learn idiosyncrasies, and you either adjust to them or you change them or you embrace them, and it makes every performance different. And yeah, certainly I've worked with orchestras in every continent except for Africa and dozens of countries, multiple cities in all of those countries. And so we can't always speak the same verbal language, but we always can speak the same musical language. So that is always that one connective tissue that we all have in common, where we can make anything work.
How many rehearsals do you get?
Not many. A grand total, usually of two. So for people who don't know, so the typical professional orchestral rehearsal is 2.5 hours with the 15-minute break. So that's if you're lucky, you get 5 hours of music, and then you're on to a performance. So it's testament to the incredible musicianship that you experience out there in the wild that they can pick up the music to Harry Potter, which is some of the most difficult film music ever written. Or for that matter, I just did Star Wars over in Germany for an entire month, and just going all over the entire country, and that it's murder on the brass. It's great music. I love it, and they love it, but it beats them up because they're just playing constantly. And so it's always an adventure, and we always get through it. Sometimes it's a little hairier than others. We just get through at the nick of time, but the fact that they can pull that off with such limited rehearsal time, and we are able to make it line up with the film. So we work out all the tempos, and they adjust to me. And I adjust to them. It really is. I give so much credit to them, and I only hope I play a small part in making sure that ship stays on course.
Who is the best orchestra that you work with?
It's a really tough one, and I'm going to be cheesy. And instead of for technical reasons, I will say the best orchestra that I work with is the one that was the first orchestra that I ever saw because it has sentimental value to me, which seems like a cop out, but it actually it electrifies me when I play with them, which is the Hartford Symphony. I grew up in Connecticut, and so my first symphony concerts that I ever saw were with the Hartford Symphony, and I thought these people were gods up there. Just and I was just starting to dip my toe into orchestral music and classical music, and here are these people just rip roaring on stage, and I got to meet a few of them afterwards, and some of them came into my school to talk about what they did, and here I am in front of this orchestra about to lead them. It was my first rehearsal working with them was simultaneously the most joyous and terrifying experience,
Yeah.
and they're all really nice. They're all great people, but it felt like the most high stakes. And I've conducted Philadelphia Orchestra, I've conducted Chicago Symphony, New York Philharmonic. I've conducted all of them, and they are absolutely phenomenal. And you get nerves working with them too. But yeah, it was that sentimental value that I'm, oh, don't screw this up. And luckily to this day, we work together and we have not only film music concert series, but classical concert series that I go in for. And I have a great relationship with them now. So it went all right. But they are my favorite orchestra to work with just because they mean so much to me.
Okay, what was the worst situation that happened to you? And you don't have to n name names, but just the situation. What was the worst one?
Sure. I won't say the country and I won't say where. It was early days of conducting Harry Potter. And again, like I said, it was Harry Potter is incredibly difficult film music. The string writing in particular, there are top tier string musicians who sweat the Harry Potter part. And they put it on orchestra auditions now to challenge people because if you can't play this, we don't want you. So to have to walk that into an orchestra from any given place, that's terrifying for them, and I feel for them. So we're often depending on contractors to find the best premier orchestra in the area, not because we want to be snooty about it, but because this music's so difficult, you need people who can play it. And this contractor found us what he assured us was the finest orchestra in the area, and it turns out they were a high school orchestra, and these kids, I came in for rehearsal, they were doing their best. The attitude was so wonderful, and they were playing the best they possibly could, but we couldn't even get through one movement of it, and it took 45 minutes of that 2.5 hour rehearsal, the first one. And I had to do what I've never had to do before or since, which is call a break, not tell them why, but pull the contractor aside and say, this concert's not happening with this orchestra. And by that point, the contractor knew that he screwed up. And so they flew in another orchestra on their dime. And I went back out there and we treated the rest of the rehearsal like a masterclass, basically. We tried to, make it a positive experience for the kids. They knew it wasn't going well, so I switched gears and I worried less about time. And we only played one piece, but I got into the emotion about it, how John Williams constructed it, and it actually ended up being a really cool rehearsal because I never get the time to just. So here's why you chose the tuba to play this. And when you think about it, it really ties back to when the bassoons are doing this. So it ended up being really, really fun after that moment of terror of, oh gosh, is this concert where they've spent millions of dollars and 10,000 people are coming going to happen? So that was by far the most nerve-wracking, and I'd say probably worst in terms of sheer terror that I'd
I
ever
bet.
experienced
I
out
bet.
on the road.
Okay, let's switch gears to film scoring.
Sure.
Budgets are tight, which I
Yes,
don't have to
yes.
tell you about. So, how do you approach that as a result?
Yeah, well, I will say now that we're in a very strange position in Hollywood, where a lot of my friends have likened it to a Hollywood depression that we're kind of going through right now. There's a lot of shifting gears going on, and nobody knows really where it's going to end up. And there's multiple factors to that. But yeah, it's navigating. Hollywood is mostly navigating personalities, and the money sort of is intertwined with that, including budgets and things like that. I personally take the approach where I don't allow myself to be a pushover, but I weigh how much I'm going to enjoy a project, even if it's a smaller budget, versus how much of a pain it's going to be to do versus the personalities involved. Because I've done some films where I only made $1,000 for 2 hours of music, heavy orchestral music, so lots of notes. But I did it because I love the people involved, and they were having fun in the production, and we all had a common goal, and it was a project I believed in. So there was that. And then there was another one where I made much more money comparatively, and the director and producer were fighting the entire time. And as is always the case, both parties will turn to the composer to not to be therapist, but to get one over on the other guy. So the director will say, "I know the producer wants this. Forget about him. Just do this, like I'm saying. He won't even notice." And then the producer's on the other side saying the exact same thing. So finding that little middle ground of how about I give you this so it makes him happy, but it also makes you happy. And so he ended playing therapist or sometimes preschool teacher a bit. And then the budget starts weighing on your mind a lot more. How much am I making for this job here? So yeah, it's an interesting time to be working in the industry. And at the end of the day, it really does come down to, am I making music that I really love? Usually, yes. And I take great solace in that fact on those really stressful days where you have to push through. I don't know if that answered your question, but
I'm curious how you feel about augmenting your scores with samples.
yeah, no, sure. I had a visceral reaction to that because it's something that weighs heavily on me. Again, because of my conducting background and my performing background, and the fact that I grew up with John Williams and James Horner, Jerry Goldsmith, all these people were using huge live orchestras and they sounded amazing. They stand the test of time. When I first started learning how to compose, sample libraries were, well, I'm a college student. Obviously, I can't afford to hire an orchestra to come in for my homework assignment. So here's this really terrible sample library that at least my teacher will get an approximation of what it was supposed to sound like. That was 4,000 years ago, and now we're at a place where you have some sample libraries that I'm hard pressed to even find to pick out what's real and what isn't, especially if you mix in live performance within that. I have the approach where if, and I often do have to use a lot of sample libraries, I should say, just because of the nature of my scores and what people asking me, because I am a very traditional composer where I write big orchestral scores, and a lot of people don't have the budget for that. But I do have a policy where I always work in at least 5 to 10 live musicians, even if it comes out of my pay, because it's giving people jobs, it's paying it forward, it makes the music sound better, because there's no way you can replicate a human performance, and especially the imperfections, which I think is where the music's at. It's in the little imperfections, in the little interpretations. I'm the king of asides here, but I was just having a discussion about Baroque music with a colleague of mine, and there's a, I forget the name, and I wouldn't be able to pronounce it right because it's a French word. So I butcher it anyways, but it's the concept that no two notes should ever sound the same, even if you play them back to back to back to back. You should be shorter, a little bit louder, a little bit softer, a little bit flatter, sharper, everything like that. And I think that is so, it's so French, but it's also so human. And I think that's where music lies. And sample libraries have gotten better about kind of working in the humanity to the sounds, which is scary, but it's also great if you need to use them. But there still is no match for just taking one of my best flautist friends, plopping them in a room, putting the microphone in front of them, and they're happy to do it. And you know, we're keeping live music alive, so to speak, even if, the percussion section unfortunately is all sampled or something like that. So yeah, it is something that weighs heavily on me. I don't necessarily enjoy the fact that I have to use entirely sampled orchestras occasionally. But at the same time, yeah, budgets, as you said, are small. And when you don't have the I'm doing air quotes. I know the video won't be on the podcast, but when they don't have the budget for a full orchestra, you do what you can and make things work as best you can.
Do you ever go overseas, like to Prague?
I haven't yet, but and I've worked with several of those orchestras just from my classical conducting. But I've already sort of I've set it in my mind now. And I know I'm going to be working on a film with a director friend of mine coming up, and I'm warming him up to the idea of it, which is scary to a director because, if you're working with a sample library and there's something he doesn't like or she doesn't like or the producer doesn't like, it's just a matter of going in there and tweaking either my Pro Tools session or going into my DAW and shifting around some MIDI data. When it's recorded with a live orchestra, it gets a little bit trickier if someone wants to make a change at the last moment. But I think I have them on the ropes where we're actually going to be able to record it with a live orchestra. So Prague, Qatar, I know I've had some musician friends work with them, and they are a stellar orchestra. There's orchestras in Romania that sound absolutely amazing. And even in Germany, I work with Film Orchestra Babelsberg a lot in the same studio where Metropolis was filmed all those years ago. So it's great just to be on that campus, let alone working with them. So yeah, those are always possibilities for the future, and I'm pushing people to allow me to do that.
John, just out of curiosity, what DAW do you use?
Yeah, I am I'm a weirdo. I can function with all of them, but the first one I learned was Cakewalk Sonar. And I am a firm believer in as long as it functions and plays nicely with everything else, stick to what you're most you're fastest with and what you can get the job done with. And so to this day, I still that's my go-to. And if I need to use and I use Pro Tools for mastering, just because that's what I learned mastering on. So if that makes you by nature slower because you're using multiple programs, well then I just learn to go faster with everything and hope it all washes out. So yeah, I'm a bit of an odd duck in that sense. You don't hear a lot of Cakewalk Sonar people.
No, you don't actually, but you know what, again, there's something to be said for comfort because again, you can work faster and that's what counts.
And it's kind of the same thing with Finale versus Sibelius and everything like that. I learned on Finale, and I can do anything on Finale. So sometimes I think Sibelius scores are prettier, or Dorico, a lot of people are using now. But at the end of the day, I know how to use Finale, so I use Finale or pencil and paper when I can. So.
You're a real purist, boy, doing it manually. Okay,
Yes.
last question, John. What's the best piece of advice that maybe someone imparted to you or you learned along the way?
Yeah, you always hear that old phrase, if you can think of something else to do, do it. I don't necessarily agree with that with the film industry, or with any music. I think as long as music makes you happy, and it fulfills a part of your soul, part of your heart, keep trying at it. And if that's not where the money comes from, then you'll find something to make the money come from. But keep it in your life. It's a lot like what my parents told me when I first went to college, which is this is a hard life. Not very many people make it, but you'll always have it, whether you, by definition of what the world says, succeed at it. You'll always have it, even if you're playing organ at church, you get a church job, or playing with a jazz combo at a bar. Stick with it. Don't let people scare you off by how hard it is. And it is that hard. But not trying is so much worse than trying and then just realizing, you know what? I'm just gonna do this for fun, and I'm going to work at a 9-to-5 job to make my money. So that's the piece of advice I would give to people. A little bit more hopeful than that. If you can think of anything else to do, do that instead.
You can find out more about John at johnjasensky.com. That's John Jasensky, JohnJasensky.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There, you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.